So if the movie Lincoln is an attempt to sweep away the myths and legends of Abe Lincoln and show his reality, the release of the latest James Bond movie, Skyfall, is a direct plunge into the legend and myth behind espionage and the British institution MI6. James Bond can do anything. That's his charm and allure, part hero and part fixer. He is no part truth. And for the truth about MI6, we go to Gordon Carrera, author of The Act of Betrayal, The Secret History of MI6, and a security correspondent for our partner, the BBC. Gordon, welcome back to the show.
Good to speak to you, John.
This is an amazing story, and it's striking to me just how absolutely it has nothing whatsoever to do with Bond, even though you can kind of get a sense of where the Bond legend comes from. It's almost as though MI6 wished to be someone like Bond because their reality was so dreadfully not.
Well, I think that's a good way of putting it. Right now, if you look at MI6, it's a kind of bureaucratic professional organization in which the lawyers tell you what to do, and where it exists and plays by certain rules. And you'd have to go back a few decades to really get to where the myth comes from. I interviewed a chief of MI6 a few years ago, and I said to him, I've got to ask you the James Bond question. Is there a license to kill? And he looked at me and he kind of scoffed and went, no, don't be silly. And of course not. And I said, has there ever been one? And there was this wonderful pause where he kind of thought, how do I answer that? And he said, after a bit of a pause, well, not to my knowledge. And I think that gives you a sense that if you go back 50 years, there was a bit of Bond, only a bit though. And I think what's interesting is that the Bond myth has become wrapped up a bit in reality, and at times MI6 might have liked a bit of Bond to rub off on them. I mean, you know, someone, another chief of MI6 who now retired, once said to me, you know, one of the great advantages of Bond for us is that when we go, you know, into the middle of nowhere and we introduce ourselves, they go, ah, Mr. Bond, you know, from the British Secret Service. And he said to me, you know, we wouldn't get that welcome if we were from the Belgian Secret Service, you know, which, you know, I guess is true. So, you know, they've kind of lived off the myth as well. There is a bit of truth of it, you know, if you went back to the kind of Second World War and the period right after. But I think when you get to the modern world, it's quite a bit away from that. And I think the real MI6 struggles to know whether they want to take on a bit of the glamour of it, or whether they want to say, look, it's nothing like that, and we don't go out killing people, and, you know, we're accountable to the government and all these other things.
Was MI6 originally envisioned as a technologically driven kind of spy service, or was it more a mobilization of Britain's expertise, knowledge of the world from the colonial period, into one place where they could speak the language of the places that were now involved in the Cold War?
Well, I think that's right, in that it's come out of Britain's empire to some extent, and a lot of the work of British intelligence was dealing with the end of empire and the aftermath of empire. There's always a bit of technology, and right in the beginning, when it started before the First World War, the first chief of MI6, Mansfield Cummings, used to love gadgets, and he used to love, you know, invisible ink and things like that. So there's always been a bit of, you know, of gadgetry involved. But I think once you then get to the Cold War period, it's very interesting, because in a sense, the James Bond books and the particularly when Ian Fleming wrote them, were kind of post-imperial fantasy for Britain. It was the reality was that the British Empire was passing away, and Britain's leadership role, if you like, was passing to the Americans. But in the world of James Bond, they could still be number one. They were still the really clever ones. And yeah, you might get a bit of help from the Americans and the CIA, but really, in the world of fantasy, Britain could still do everything, and one man could save the world. And that was a kind of reassurance for Britain in the 50s, after Suez and after a lot of setbacks, that, you know, at least our spies were still able to do these amazing things.
You know, the title of your book is The Art of Betrayal, The Secret History of MI6. I mean, in that title suggests the real irony here. The biggest characters in this story are the ones that sold out MI6, not the ones that made it succeed.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I think if you go to that early Cold War period, it's a pretty dark period for MI6. I mean, this is the time of Kim Philby, above all, who was the MI6 rising star after the Second World War. He was the station chief, the liaison with Washington, you know, a very powerful position. And all the time, he was really a Soviet agent and passing secrets to the other side. And it was a huge blow to MI6, because it held up a mirror to them and said, well, maybe it's not Bond. And out of that slightly darker period, you got a very different view of the secret world in the form of Le Carré and Smiley. And John Le Carré, who'd been in MI5 and MI6, witnessed and saw this very bleak period of moulds and betrayal, and so wrote a much darker, a much more complex and morally ambiguous view of MI6, based on his experience in that post-war world of basically of betrayal, and in which MI6 has been betrayed. And that's different from Ian Fleming's Bond, which was actually really born in the Second World War, when Ian Fleming, the author of the Bond novels, was in naval intelligence and was coming up with all kinds of, you know, crazy, exciting operations, which were more like Bond. So you can see, in a way, you've got Bond and Smiley, Le Carré Smiley, are two different poles of the intelligence world and of the way MI6 has been portrayed.
One thought about Bond and his sexiness, sometimes it's a little annoying to just see how that's portrayed in the movies, but in your story, sex is really a weapon of MI6 and is a theme of how espionage is actually conducted. Explain.
Well, I think that's right. I think if you look at this period, the honey trap was real, and people on both sides were using them, and using them to ensnare people and to ensnare foreign diplomats into passing secrets and basically being put in what you might call compromising positions, where having been maybe filmed or snapped in such a compromising situation, you would then be compromised in terms of your loyalties and persuaded to betray one way or another. And that happened to Britons and also to Soviet diplomats. So in a sense, it was a slightly less glamorous view of sex than you might get in the James Bond books, that's for sure.
Gordon Crara, is there a file, a box you'd love to open, a piece of this secret world of MI6 that is still out of your reach?
Oh, I think there's quite a lot. I mean, really, MI6 still pretty much keeps a lot of its secrets. I mean, it's pretty hard to get at some of the stories in the last few decades, and it's opened up a bit. So even if you went back, you know, 20 years, you'd have found that MI6 didn't even formally exist. I mean, it wasn't acknowledged to exist by the government. So only recently has it started to open up, but there's a lot of files that I would love to see about some of the agents, some of the operations, some of the rumours about who might really have been a traitor and why. So I think there's still quite a lot to be discovered, that's for sure.
Any British leaders cyborgs?
Not as far as I know, although I think the British public sometimes thinks one or two might be, but I don't think so.
All right, Gordon Carrera, author of The Art of Betrayal: The Secret History of MI6, security correspondent for the BBC. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All this week we've been talking about what you want to see accomplished in the next 4 years.
I think that the new administration should focus on women's rights and equal pay for equal work.
Thanks, Kathy, from New York. Michael in Salem says it's time to take a cue from Colorado and Washington.
I think in the next 4 years, the government and the White House are going to have to face the reality of the failed war on drugs and start treating it as a medical condition, as a public health issue, rather than putting people in jail for it.
Referring to ballot measures there in Colorado and Washington, give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. Next time on the program, on Veterans Day, Adam Driver from the hit HBO show Girls and the new movie Lincoln joins us to talk about why Veterans Day matters to him as a former Marine. Bond or Lincoln? Think about it, folks. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Have a great weekend.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.